Со двора подъезд известный под названием «Черный ход». В том подъезде, как в поместье, проживает черный кот. Он в усы усмешку прячет, темнота ему как щит. Все коты поют и плачут.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of New Books in Russian and Eurasia Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sean Guillory. Every podcast, I talk to an author about their new book on Russia or Eurasia. In this episode, I spoke with Daniel Treisman about his new book, The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, journalists, academics, and policymakers have sought to make sense of post-Soviet Russia. Is Russia an emerging or retrograde democracy? A free market or Byzantine capitalism? Adopting Western values or forever steeped in Asiatic mores? Is Russia in transition, and if so, transitioning to what? Usually the answers to these questions are rooted in Russophilia or Russophobia, colored by teleological assumptions and crude stereotypes, as if to reaffirm Churchill's quip that Russia is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside of an enigma. To many, the nature of today's Russia remains elusive. The first lines of Daniel Treisman's new book, The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, signifies a change in tone. Whatever Russia is, Treisman asserts, one indisputable fact is clear, quote, Russia has returned, not to the West, of which it was never truly a part, but to the world, end quote. Treisman's text is one of the most refreshing, least ideologically driven, and erudite explorations into the journey Russia has taken over the last 20 years, which each step the reader is urged to rethink, speculate, and even reevaluate many of the myths about Russia's past, present, and future. So here is my interview with Daniel Treisman. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. Thanks for taking the time to talk about your new book, The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. Just to begin, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got interested in contemporary Russian politics?
Sure. Well, I'm a professor of political science at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. This year, I'm actually on sabbatical, a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna. My background is in political science, specializing in Russia. I really became interested in Russia when I was in graduate school in the mid-80s. It was 1986, and I was starting in the political science department and looking for an area specialization. In looking around the world in 1986, it seemed that something might be about to happen in Russia, and I began learning Russian at that point. And I haven't been disappointed, really, from 1986 to the present. There have been just an uninterrupted series of surprises, even some years when the surprise was that there was no surprise. But the country has remained continuously interesting and challenging to understand, and so I've done my best to do so.
And what brought you to write this particular book?
Well, there's a great tendency in academia to focus on very narrow, precisely defined questions, and to seek out exactly the evidence that will establish a case on those narrow questions. And I decided a few years ago that I became frustrated with only doing that. And I wanted to know what I actually thought about the big questions. I went back at that point and started reading all the memoirs, rereading all the historical material of the last 20 years. Seemed like a good stretch of time to try and draw some conclusions about what had been happening in Russia. And I tried to force myself to answer the big questions to the extent that one could with the material available. So I ended up writing this book, which draws some conclusions based on what we know at present, or at least what I think I know at present, about what has happened in Russia since 1985, including why the Soviet Union disintegrated, what went wrong with Gorbachev's attempt at economic and political reform, what explains Yeltsin's various decisions. There's a chapter on the war in Chechnya and various other aspects of Russia's transition or Russia's experience in these last two decades.
Mm-hmm. And you do challenge actually some prevailing myths about this period too, which I really appreciate and we'll get to later on. Just to get into the book itself, the first few chapters deals with the political personalities of Mikhail Gorbachev, Boris Yeltsin, Vladimir Putin, and Dmitry Medvedev. Let's begin with Gorbachev, who you call the captain, and I like the titles that you gave each one of these individuals. How does the moniker of the captain, what does the moniker of the captain say about Gorbachev as a politician and a reformer?
Right. Well, this was actually an image that he used in his memoirs in one or two places. He referred to himself as steering a ship. And it seemed to me, for several reasons, an interesting metaphor. Clearly, it suggests somebody who views the state as a vessel of some kind, which can be moved in a particular direction, and which is led by a single individual. Now, there was another sense in which it seemed to me that Gorbachev's experience as leader of the Soviet Union was like a captain steering a ship, and that is that the ocean is often unpredictable. And in this case, as I say in the book, the course that he charted led into a hurricane, which he was simply ill-equipped to steer the boat out of. Now, there's also a quote that I like very much from a Russian economist who said of Gorbachev that he was like Columbus, that he discovered a new world, but he didn't realize what it was. As Columbus thought that he discovered India, Gorbachev thought that he was turning the Soviet Union into a kind of humane socialist, more modern socialist society. But in fact, he was destroying the remnants of communism and opening the door for the development of a capitalist and ultimately democratic, imperfectly democratic regime. So he really didn't understand where he was going. But like Columbus, he discovered something tremendously important.
Do you think, and this is something that's asked about or reevaluating Gorbachev, do you think he knew where he was going, like he had a plan of sorts, or was he just kind of making things up as he was going along?
Well, reading what he wrote, and of course in retrospect he tries to give it a more coherent feel, but even taking that into account, reading what he wrote and reading also accounts month by month and day by day, one certainly gets the impression that that he was improvising. And of course, who would not be improvising and reacting given how much things changed within a very short period of time? So I don't think he had a master plan, and the way he talks about it was much more a matter of instinct that something had to change, that things could not continue as they had been, and a sort of moral sense of direction, I think, as he saw it, that one had to, one couldn't use repression in the way that it had been used in the past. And at one point, talking to some aides, he said, well, of course, we could use force, but не хочется. It just doesn't feel right. I just don't feel like it.
And in your estimation, why did his reforms ultimately fail?
Well, there's a running theme through the book, which I obviously didn't choose, but sort of was chosen for me by the process of the research, which is that the economy had an enormous influence over how politics developed. And I think the reason things really fell apart for Gorbachev had to do with the economic reforms, the economic policies that he initiated in his first 3 years, essentially, 1985 to 1988, which started a process of complete disintegration within the planned Soviet economy, but which didn't liberate the forces of a market economy. And so ultimately, I think what caused the Soviet population to turn against him decisively in 1990-1991 was food shortages and extreme shortages of consumer goods, which I think were the result of his early economic policies.
Now let's move on to Yeltsin, who you call the natural. Why the natural?
Well, the natural in the sense of a natural election campaigner. And I think that if there's one thing that really characterizes Yeltsin, and it's clearly not the one thing that would occur to everybody, but to me, the one thing about Yeltsin which was most important in determining his course and in causing him to side with democracy, even when it seemed that he was facing serious problems, was his intuitive sense that he was a good election campaigner, that he had this ability to connect to ordinary people. And in fact, he was extremely good at this. Now, he had to do this in conditions which would have challenged the most expert political campaigner from any country, an economy that was doing extremely badly, collapsing over the course of many years. But I think at key moments, what really saved Yeltsin from moving in the direction of more authoritarian government was his belief that ultimately he had this connection to the people, that he could if only he got out on the campaign trail and met them, he could make that connection again, and that this was really the heart of politics, and something that he uniquely was situated to do.
One of the interesting myths that you dispel is the popular narrative that Yeltsin was a tool of the oligarchs. In what ways is this narrative problematic?
Right. Well, it's so convenient, isn't it? There were so many different groups for which the image of Yeltsin as a puppet of the oligarchs was convenient. First of all, the oligarchs themselves benefited from this impression of being extremely influential, having Yeltsin's ear. Investment partners took them more seriously and so on. And it also appealed to their vanity. It was a godsend for the communists who could discredit Yeltsin by saying he is the tool of these dishonest capitalists. I think for journalists covering Russia in the 1990s, it was a very convenient sort of shorthand explanation with lots of vivid individuals to picture, to profile. It was a shorthand explanation for why things seemed to be going so badly, and it had this moralistic element which I think appeals to journalists at times. So there were various, for many different groups, this image of Yeltsin as being controlled by oligarchs was very attractive. But if one looks closely at the decisions that were made, especially in the period when the oligarchs were supposedly extremely powerful, which is really after 1996, so 1997, 1998, mm-hmm. One finds that on a whole series of issues, they didn't, in fact, get what they wanted. In many small ways they did, but in the big fights that they picked, and I'm thinking in particular of the oligarch of oligarchs, Boris Berezovsky, he didn't get what he wanted. And the cases in which they did get what they were fighting for were relatively few. So I think it's a problematic image, and the evidence just isn't really there that Russian politics was being controlled by the oligarchs. Now, I should say they did have a role. They got I say in the book that they didn't always get their way, but they got in the way. They distracted the government, members of the government. They corrupted various officials. They endlessly fought among themselves. They used their media outlets to slander each other and to distract from the very difficult tasks of government at that time. So they were part of the scene, but I think their influence was greatly exaggerated.
Now, in your chapter on Putin, you titled it Unreasonable Doubt. And what does this phrase say about Putin as a man and a politician?
Right. Well, the framing image that I use in that chapter is of the destruction caused by bombs that were placed in four apartment buildings in 1999. And these bombs were blamed on Chechen terrorists from the Caucasus. There were various aspects of the investigation, and I should say the lack of investigation into these bombings, that produced doubts in the minds of many people. There was one aspect which was particularly troubling, which was in the city of Vrazan, white powder was found in sacks in the basement of another apartment building. It was later said to be part of an exercise that had been organized by the KGB to check on local vigilance, and that in fact this white powder was sugar. But many people wondered if they'd been told the whole story. So it seemed to me that even though the vast majority of Russians did not believe that, obviously, that Putin and the country's leaders were responsible for such a terrible thing, there was some lingering doubt which was not dispelled because there was never a convincing public investigation. And I think the Putin era was really characterized by, on the one hand, the booming economy, rising incomes, a feeling of at least economic stability, relative stability. But on the other hand, in the back of people's minds, at least the more politically aware people, this element of doubt which could never quite be dispelled.
Mm-hmm. Especially Putin's background in the security police also continues to cast a shadow over him as like a suspicious, making him a suspicious figure.
Yes, he's naturally implicated in anything that people attribute to the security services, to the former KGB and the FSB.
A favorite pastime amongst Russia watchers is to try to understand Putin's motivation. What do you think drives the political and policy choices he made as president?
Right. Well, in the book, I run through a number of possibilities, and I have to say, there's no way to be sure of this. This is the part of the book which gets most into speculation.
Mm-hmm. You referred to him at one point as opaque, I think.
Oh, yes. I find him very opaque. I've met him a couple of times in large groups in these settings where people are allowed to ask questions and then he replies. And I found that completely uninformative. He's very difficult to read, and the many people who claim to have detailed knowledge of what he thinks, I don't find very credible. So it comes down to a lot of evaluating the evidence we have, some deduction, and some simply working out plausible scenarios and hypotheses. And so the one that I think fits best, for me at least, is that although obviously there are many sides to him, perhaps the most important side was Putin as Putin thinking in the terms of a major international businessman, that his real passion was for running Gazprom, the gas monopoly, and that what's most characteristic about his regime ultimately is not the KGB side so much as the fact that some of his acquaintances have grown very rich. And we've seen this is now changing a little, but we've seen many of his members of his government and close aides in leading positions in state-owned enterprises on the boards and so on. So I present this image of Putin as the chief executive officer, or Putin the international businessman, and with his goals being fundamentally to further the interests of a network of associates in business. Now, that's in some ways consistent with developing the economy, and of course, in his position, he has to be very concerned about his popularity and staying in power. But unlike most products of the Soviet KGB, he seems to be completely comfortable with capitalism. With capitalism with a large role for the state, but nevertheless, international capitalism. And this perspective seems to be how he thinks about many problems.
You call Dmitry Medvedev the understudy. Now, what does this title say about him as a politician and about his anointment as Russia's president?
Right. Well, everybody understood from the start that Medvedev was Putin's trusted protege, that he was part of the Putin team, and everybody expected him to be loyal to Putin. And I think we've seen that actually describes what's happened. Now, I think in addition to the personal loyalty that Medvedev certainly feels towards Putin, who's been his mentor for many, many years, I think we need to recognize that the room for maneuver of Medvedev in the current setup is very limited. On paper, the powers of the Russian president are enormous, but in practice, for Medvedev to do anything to implement any decision, he needs to go through the government, which is under Prime Minister Putin. If he wants to pass a law, he needs to get it enacted by the Duma, which is dominated by United Russia, the party led by Putin. And so Medvedev's real levers to do something in Russia are quite restricted unless Putin agrees. So Medvedev has never been an independent player in Russian politics, in part because he was chosen to be Putin's man, but in part because the institutional setup is such that he's quite hemmed in by political constraints.
Mm-hmm. And you think some of those also exist outside of, say, Putin's control too, in the sense of the bureaucracy in general and various factions within it, or even factions within his own government, and also out in the regions.
Right. I think we often exaggerate the ability of somebody sitting in Moscow to cause change in policy throughout the country. in practice, very many decisions are not implemented or not fully implemented. As we know, there's a great deal of corruption within the Russian bureaucracy, and beyond corruption, just inefficiency. For Medvedev, and also I would say for Putin, the image of them as all-powerful is quite misleading. They are, of course, the central players in the political game, but the bureaucracy, the state that they have to work with, is far from a well-oiled machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is a perennial problem going back, you know, since Peter the Great. So the Russian leaders haven't been able to conquer this successfully.
Yes.
Now, Putin, once Medvedev becomes president, they form this new type of rule, which they refer to as the tandem. And there's always speculation on the relationship between Putin and Medvedev. Is there a split in the tandem? You especially see this in the headlines in the last month or so. What is your assessment of this relationship? And speculate as to where do you see it's going as the 2012 elections approach?
Sure. Well, so everybody wants to know who's really in charge, who's really in control. Is it Putin? Is it Medvedev? My view of this is that really it doesn't matter who is in charge, because they are part of the same team. They're extremely closely linked. Their goals and their interests are very closely aligned. They've known each other for about 20 years and worked together for most of that time. I see the attempt to see struggles or differences between them as a little bit naive. Now, I do think there's a division of labor between them, and this has been the case from the start. So Medvedev's mission has been to appeal to the intellectual elite, the more sophisticated, highly educated pro-Western circles, mostly the younger generation, and predominantly in Moscow and St. Petersburg. Putin's job has been to appeal to mainstream Russians out in the provinces. And this means that their messages and their rhetoric have been somewhat different, and occasionally they've even conflicted. So Medvedev has sounded more modern, more open to liberal ideas. Putin has come across more down-to-earth, more nationalist, more hesitant about cooperating with the West. And we've seen this, I think, throughout the period of the tandem. But the contradictions or the apparent differences have become much more salient in recent months. So what's going on? I think Medvedev's credibility over the last 3 years has gotten lower and lower with the elites to whom it's his job to appeal. So he has not been able, or perhaps not even been willing, to implement the kind of modernization reforms that he claimed to support. And I think in the last 6 months or so, we've really seen the elites in Moscow, St. Petersburg, giving up on him, perhaps once and for all. And so this leaves him in a very awkward situation, because his usefulness to Putin, the role that he needs to play in the system, is that of appealing to these elites as well as to Western circles. And if he's no longer able to do that, if he's lost all credibility, then that changes the calculus for Putin in thinking about what to do in the upcoming election season. So it increases the incentive for Putin to decide to introduce some new face into the political constellation, perhaps Putin coming back as president and a new, more credible reformist as prime minister, or perhaps even to have some new symbol of liberalism, let's say, running as president. And Medvedev understands this and so is trying to renew his credibility, to rebuild it with the elites that are his constituency. And ironically, the best way to do that is by attacking Putin.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what we see, to the extent we see anything. And really, we shouldn't exaggerate. The differences of wording are sort of they seem significant because they're more than we've seen to date.
Right.
But the spokesman later soften the edges and retract in little ways. So I think that's what we see. Medvedev is trying to, at this point, looking ahead to 2012, he's trying to establish his credibility to convince Putin that he is still a valuable player. And I think Putin understands that that requires him to distinguish himself from Putin, and sometimes quite sharply. Now, it's a dangerous game because he could go too far and really irritate Putin, which would not be good for him. And I doubt that it will actually work. My feeling at this point is that Medvedev really can't rebuild his credibility with the elites in Moscow. So, but I'm not sure that he has a better strategy available. I'm not sure that there is some other course that would work better. So that's my view of what's been happening in the last 6 months, and I would expect to see more of that as we get closer to the election, until Putin and Medvedev make a final decision about who the candidate is going to be.
I guess this is what they mean when they say we'll make the decision according to present political conditions. And what you just elaborated kind of illuminates that phrase to me a little bit more.
Yeah, I think, my feeling, and obviously, as I said earlier, I can't read Putin's mind, but my feeling is that that Putin really has not decided yet. In fact, it seems to be a character trait that he doesn't like to make decisions until he has to. So he can be decisive when sort of forced to make a decision, but up to that point, he often delays. And I think it's quite rational, because a lot of what's going to happen in the next political season, I think, is going to depend on what's going to change in the economy in the coming months.
Do you think he also does this because, in a way, it keeps those his subordinates kind of on their toes, so they're not picking a side too prematurely, and who will be running for president? I mean, I'm speaking here, there's always speculation about various clans within the government. And one way to kind of keep them, you know, on their toes is to really not make a decision until the last minute.
Right. Well, clearly, if he were to announce that it was not going to be Medvedev, then it would be very difficult for Medvedev to really remain doing what he's doing. He would be a completely lame duck. That could sort of destabilize the system to some extent if everybody started treating him with disrespect or simply ignoring his instructions. I mean, more than they typically do anyway. I think Putin doesn't want to undermine Medvedev's authority prematurely, even if he does plan to, he does decide to replace Medvedev. They're also creating some, the political elite in Moscow is in this state of nervous agitation. The political technologists, people like Gleb Pavlovsky and all the others, they feel that they have to make a decision about who they're backing, and it's a very risky decision. So there's this sense of anxiety and insecurity in Moscow created by this this lack of a candidate. So it's a balance. I think Putin doesn't want to destabilize the government, but on the other hand, he is creating nervousness within the political elite.
Right, certainly. Now, let's move on to the second half of the book, which details some key issues in Russia over the last 20 years, and the first of which is the demise of the Soviet Union as a geopolitical unit. In your view, what caused the breakup of the USSR?
Well, I think it was, I think to point to any single factor is too simplistic. I think it was really the combination of a series of elements. So the economic crisis that undermined Gorbachev's popularity was important. The development of ethno-nationalism in the various republics was important. The regional elections in 1990, which directed energy into politics at the Republican level rather than at the central level, that was important. But I think, and then ultimately, the August 91 coup attempt was important because it really undermined Gorbachev's final attempts, which probably would have failed anyway, to move to some sort of loose confederation. And it also conclusively showed the failure of the security services and army to halt the process of disintegration at that point. So I think we see over time a whole series of events and a whole series of different factors interacting in a certain way, which led to this outcome, which I think, as of 1985, was not particularly likely.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things you speak about in the book is the lack of violence that the breakup of the USSR, that there was no violence or in the breakup of the USSR. And this is unlike what we saw with the Ottoman Empire or decolonization and the disintegration of Yugoslavia. Why was there no violence, in your view?
Right. Well, I should qualify that a bit because there was violence, and estimates differ, but probably somewhere between, I don't know, 40,000 and 100,000 people were killed in the various wars, Nagorno-Karabakh and various other ones. But compared to the disintegration of major ethnically mixed states, even compared to Yugoslavia, there was surprisingly little violence. And so I think Yeltsin deserves a certain amount of credit for this. In very difficult circumstances, he negotiated, and as you know, he's reviled for having signed the Bieloviskaya agreement, which brought the Soviet Union to an end. But the process of negotiations that Yeltsin engaged in with Ukraine and Belarus, I think, provided some stability. And Yeltsin's careful attempt to keep not to threaten Ukraine, eventually signing a friendship treaty with Ukraine in 1997, I think this was very important. Not supporting Russian separatists in the Crimea, that was very important. So I think that was part of it. But it is still somewhat puzzling and impressive that the Russian ethnically Russian communities, the very large diaspora in some of the other Soviet republics, such as Kazakhstan and the Baltics, that these didn't flare up into bloody confrontations. Of course, there was some violence in Moldova and Pridnestrovia, but by and large, there was relatively little. And I think that's impressive, and it remains a bit of a puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Now, the economic reforms of the 1990s are probably the most controversial topic among Russian washers. What were some of the challenges in transforming Russia's economy to a capitalist system?
Wow. Well, really, really everything. I mean, we looking at this period, some people say, oh, look, the economy collapsed in the 1990s, must be because of economic reform. But what that neglects is the fact that the economy was collapsing before the start of economic reform, and for reasons that had to do with, first of all, the inefficiency of the Soviet system, and secondly, the disorganization introduced by Gorbachev's reforms. But sort of the challenges were really to create from scratch a market economy, to liberate ordinary Russians to trade, to turn what was largely an economy of state ownership with state-owned enterprises into a economy dominated by private enterprises. I think there's one challenge which I've become more and more conscious of over the years, which I think was really not fully understood at the time. And this was that I would say a very large part, a very large fraction of enterprises within Russia inherited from the Soviet Union simply could not be salvaged. Many of them were located in places which were simply not sensible places to have a factory, not sensible places to have enterprises, because the Soviet objectives had included populating Siberia and had made these location decisions unrelated to economic rationality. So there were enterprises in Siberia and the Far East, which were simply more expensive to keep running than it was worth. What they were producing was simply not worth the expense of transporting food to them, transporting energy, and so on. And then many of the inherited enterprises had obsolete capital stock, which simply needed to be scrapped, and were producing goods for which there simply wasn't demand in a free economy where other enterprises and consumers weren't ordered to buy goods from these enterprises. So we had this very large set of enterprises which were really hopeless, which could not be salvaged. But if one were to close them down overnight, it would lead to tens of millions of people unemployed. And so the Yeltsin administration sort of muddled through with this problem. Many of these enterprises were kept alive with subsidies of one kind or another, even though they were not really producing very much. And this was really a social welfare strategy more than an economic strategy. And over the years, gradually, many of these enterprises have been closed down, although some are still there. But I think that was a huge problem for which there was no solution. One simply couldn't move 20 million people to different locations, and the state had no resources to provide massive retraining, welfare benefits, and so on. And so it struggled with that, and this imposed enormous costs.
Now let's turn to post-Soviet politics. What are some of the ways we can understand the ebb and the flow in Russian politics, particularly democracy to authoritarianism since 1991?
Right. Well, if we want a simple image for what has happened in democracy in Russia, I think it's two steps forward, one step back. So I would say that there was a very major breakthrough to democracy in the early 90s, probably peaking around 93, 94. Though some would dispute that. That was 93, obviously, was also the time when federal troops fired on the parliament building. But nevertheless, I would say there was this movement towards decentralization and democracy until the mid-90s, and then a gradual trend back towards recentralization, and under Putin,
a gradual rolling back of democratic freedoms, and increase in the way that elections were managed and manipulated. So big breakthrough from the end of the Soviet Union, then this two steps forward, one step back. So why has this occurred? Well, if we look at all the post-communist countries, there's a sort of geographic logic to it. First of all of them go through this initial jump towards more democratic politics. And then what happens next is quite clearly dependent on their geographical location. So the East European countries, having jumped to democracy, stay high and gradually converge even higher towards the West European countries. At the other extreme, the Central Asian republics, they make this little jump towards more democracy in 1991, then almost immediately they fall back down again.
Right. Quite low.
Yes, they become authoritarian states, clearly authoritarian states. Now, in between those, there is the Caucasus, and there's what I would call European former Soviet Union, or the European CIS, which means Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, and Moldova. And in that band, that geographical band, including the Caucasus, there's much more variation, both across the countries and over time. So we see in Belarus, it starts off very nicely, but then 94, Lukashenko is elected, and then it falls right back down to authoritarian state. At the other extreme, Moldova these days is rated pretty high when it comes to democracy, and Ukraine and Russia are lower, sort of in between Belarus and Moldova. And you see similar sort of dynamics in the Caucasus with Armenia, some years being much more democratic, some years less democratic, but all of them averaging somewhere sort of in the middle, at the lower range of democracy or the higher range of, relatively soft authoritarian government. So not to be a geographical determinist, it seems there is some sort of large. What we've seen is this pattern emerging. On the other hand, there's perhaps a hopeful sign in that within Western Europe, or within Western and Eastern Europe, the Balkans started out as being on the more authoritarian side. But has converged since the end of the Yugoslav wars, has converged towards the other East European countries. So democracy has spread south into the Balkans, and it's possible that democracy will continue to spread further east. But I think we have to see Russia in context, both geographical and also comparing Russia to countries at a similar level of economic development. And at Russia's level of economic development, if countries have democracy, it's an imperfect democracy.
Yeah, I thought this was a good analysis that you make. And we often look at Russia in relationship to, say, to Western Europe or the United States, but you actually take the position of comparing it to, say, Latin America and other types of middle income political systems or countries.
Yeah, well, I think that's a logical comparison to make. So if we look at Russia's GDP per capita, it was somewhere in the range of, averaging somewhere around 10,000, 12,000 during recent years. Other countries at a similar level of economic development are countries like Turkey, Malaysia, Argentina, Mexico. And I'm struck whenever I read about those countries by how many of the problems they have are problems that in Russia are viewed as uniquely Russian. Imperfect protection of human rights, state interference in the media, various kinds of problems with democracy from harassment of opposition parties to ballot stuffing, manipulation of the elections themselves. So it seems to me there's a syndrome of problems that we see in middle-income countries, which countries, as they develop more, gradually overcome, but which are characteristic of not just Russia, but Mexico, Argentina, Turkey, and so on. And that if we see Russia in that company, then many of the problems that people tend to think are uniquely Russian start to seem somewhat different.
Yeah, I even think there's a case to be made for comparing united Russia to Mexico's pre, when it was in power. I think that'd be an interesting comparison.
I doubt that it'll last 60 years.
That's true. That may be true. let's move on to what has been a continued problem for Russia, if not a metaphor for post-Soviet Russia, and that's Chechnya. In what ways has the war in Chechnya shaped post-Soviet Russia?
The problem of Chechnya has really metamorphosed over the years. It started out in the early 90s, before the first war, as a security problem for Russia. It was viewed as a problem of the Chechens demanding independence, and it was that to some extent. But in part, it was a problem, I argue in the book, associated with the Chechen leader, General Jokhar Dudayev, and his inability or his unwillingness to provide basic security to prevent terrorist attacks across the border. Okay, so at that point, to some extent, it was a case of a national minority which had been discriminated against terribly during the Soviet period, demanding independence within its territorial unit. Then came the war, and then came the interim between the two wars and the second war, and what started out as perhaps this nationalist uprising really changed to the element of Islamic fundamentalism increased, and it became less about Chechen independence and more about, on the one hand, individual warlords and their way of life operating within a chaotic setting through violence, and on the other hand, Islam, to the extent that there was a coherent organizing element. And at this point, many years later, the problem, I think, has metamorphosed completely into one of guerrillas organized around an Islamic fundamentalist insurgency, but who are also motivated by grievances against 20 years of abuse by the Russian Federal Security Services and the army. So it's not exactly an independent struggle at this point. In fact, I wouldn't say it's at all an independent struggle, but it's a very violent insurgency which has spread from Chechnya to Dagestan, especially Ingushetia and Kabardino-Balkaria, and could even spread further. So it's a problem which has mutated, which is just about impossible to imagine solving at this point. Clearly, there are policies that would be better than the current policies of the Russian government, but it's not easy to see any real solution. And it's a problem which now is made worse by the fact that a whole generation of Chechen young people have grown up basically without education, in conditions of civil war, essentially, and with deep resentment for the Russian forces, the security services, and no real sense of commitment to anything other than
perhaps very small units, very small groups.
Now, U.S.-Russia relations have rotated between warm to cold in the last 20 years, and now with the so-called reset, they promise to warm again. At least that's the order of the day. What issues and events have shaped U.S. relations over the last 20 years, and how do they complicate the efforts to reset them?
Well, that's a very broad question. I think there's, in the book, to try to understand the relations between the U.S. and Russia, I deliberately break it down, and I sketch out the view as perceived by, I think, many people in Moscow, in Russia, on the one hand, and also the view as perceived by Russia hands in Washington. And I argue that there's really very little overlap between the two, and that this has been a problem, that the same events are perceived in quite different ways. So I think in the 1990s, the Russian feeling was that their attempts to integrate into the West, their requests for help, their requests for being included were really ignored or rebuffed, and instead what they got was NATO expansion, the expansion of a historically hostile military alliance right up to Russia's borders. In the 2000s, I think Putin came into office hoping for an improvement in relations with the U.S. And felt gradually more and more disillusioned, feeling that the U.S. was simply not willing to cooperate with Russia. From the American side, obviously there are very, very many other aspects. But I think looking at the relationship at present, the most important fact is that the overlap in interests between Russia and the U.S. today is not very large. That one has to be realistic about that and to exploit the areas of shared interests that exist. But we need to recognize that today the Russians really don't need American help for very much. There is one issue which I think would be beneficial, which I think will eventually happen, which is Russia's membership in the World Trade Organization.
Right.
And I think that's become increasingly important for Russia in the last couple of years. But by and large, there aren't very many things that the U.S. Could offer to do for Russia at the moment. On the other hand, there are a lot of things, a lot of areas in which Russia, the U.S. could really benefit from Russian help, which follows from the fact that the U.S. has global interests, global responsibilities at the moment, and Russia is involved in many of these issue areas, such as energy security, nuclear non-proliferation, dealing with Iran and North Korea, and so on.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that Russia, too, in terms of its foreign relations, is increasingly looking to China on the one hand and Europe on the other. So they're more situated, yes, in this geopolitical, being bordered by these two great powers on their eastern and western borders.
Right. Yeah. I think the most important issue for the Russian leadership is economics. Maintaining high economic growth, prosperity within Russia. And the most important parts of the world in that regard are China and Europe. U.S. Economic relationship with Russia is extremely minor at this point. The level of trade is very low. The level of American investment in Russia is also extremely low. Compared to other countries. So the real opportunities for Russia are a closer partnership with the European Union and in the medium term, closer trade relations, growing trade relations with China.
Mm-hmm. Now, the overarching thesis of your book is that Russia has returned to the global stage. But What is this Russia that's returned, and how should we understand it in the present, and perhaps where it's going in the future?
Right. Well, that's the question that I really try to answer for myself in the course of this book. And I think the first thing to recognize is that it's a middle-income country, that with all that that entails, it's a country which has grown a lot in the last 10 years, but it's still relatively poor, about on a level with Argentina and Mexico. So it's a country that is bound to have imperfect political institutions, to have economic problems, economic instability of various kinds. So that's part of it. Politically, it's at this point a kind of soft authoritarian regime, but a very strange one, in that although the elections have been heavily manipulated in recent years, nevertheless, credible opinion polls suggest that the rulers, the incumbent rulers, Putin and Medvedev, are genuinely extremely popular. The ratings have been falling in the last few months, but still, Putin is at 69% approval and Medvedev at 66% approval. And this is credible polls from the organization, the Levada Center, which has a great reputation for independence and professionalism. So it's an authoritarian regime, but one in which elections are held, they're manipulated, but if they were run completely honestly, the current incumbents would probably win. Now that might change in the future. So at present in Moscow, people are starting to wonder whether the model is unraveling. The ratings have been falling, and if they were to fall more, we might end up in a situation where we would have elections that were manipulated, in which it wouldn't be clear whether the result had been determined by the manipulation rather than reflecting what the population actually wanted, and that would be quite a different situation. And it's really impossible to tell whether Putin and Medvedev would be able to operate under those circumstances. So it's this complicated, sort of contradictory, soft authoritarian government, which may be weakening, may be on the way out. And it's, I would say, finally, it's a country which is integrating with the world. This is the return that I talk about. But in particular, Russian society has been integrating with Europe. Russians have been studying abroad. The number of Russians studying abroad doubled in the last 10 years. Russians have been traveling abroad. So 22 million Russians took trips in 2009, last year for which we have statistics, took trips beyond the former Soviet Union. And more and more, Russians, especially the middle class, are becoming part of international networks, developing cultural ties, and in various other ways, becoming more integrated into the world. So it's no longer a country that is isolated or that can be thought of as cut off and different. It's really part of the new world, with its unattractive political institutions and its complicated economic situation. So it's a country which is changing and which will continue to change and will probably continue to surprise us, but which we should see in the context of its neighbors and in the context of other middle-income countries.
Well, it's a great book. It was incredibly informative, and it's one of the least ideological books. If in fact there's very little polemicism in the book, which I really appreciate because most books on post-Soviet Russia tend to be quite polemicist. So I really, really appreciate that. Just to wrap up the interview, since we've taken a lot of your time, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm taking a little break from major Russia projects, though I'm keeping track of what's going on with the elections approaching and so on. Lately, I've been working on something quite different, which is on what I call the geography of fear. I've been using survey data from various surveys to look at in which countries people are more afraid of various dangers.
Interesting. So
there are surveys ask about things like fear of nuclear war, fear of epidemics, fear of genetically modified food, even fear of putting on weight. And so I've been trying to analyze the levels of fear in different countries. And for one thing, it turns out that these are highly correlated. So in countries where people are afraid of one thing, they're afraid of all the others too. And other countries, they're not afraid of most things. And so I've been drawing maps and trying to figure out why some countries are more afraid and others less afraid.
That's interesting, considering how prevalent the rhetoric of fear is, at least in American politics. It's pretty pervasive. Less so now, but certainly 5 years ago, it was quite high.
Right. Well, it's clearly it's an element of politics as well as pure psychology.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. It was a great interview and very, very informative. Thanks.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Daniel Treisman about his book, The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Once again, I'm Sean Guillory, your host for New Books in Russia and Eurasia Studies. If you're interested in hearing more interviews by the New Books Network, please go to newbooksnetwork.com. And be sure to tune in next time when I talk to Louis Ziegelbaum about his book, Cars for Comrades, The Life of the Soviet Automobile. Until then, goodbye. Денег все не соберем.